It takes a really thoughtful entrepreneur to say, I'm not going to take that profit home. I'm going to roll that back into my operating company. I'm going to build the technology and the systems and the people and the offices and the scale to grow a world-class company that can execute across the whole country or across the world. That is really hard to do. And so those who are doing it, they have to take a bunch of the profit they're making from their investments in from the operating business and roll that back into the company. And if you're a regional operator, it's actually hard to be super profitable in the opco. So you're really using mostly your real estate profits to roll back into the operating platform. So if you're growing your footprint or your portfolio at the same time that you're trying to grow the footprint of your operating business so you can execute on the real estate really well, that creates a real need for GP capital.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square, where I sit down with leaders across private markets. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit with Wes Whitman, co-founder and co-managing partner of Whitman Peterson, an opportunistic real estate private equity firm. We discuss Wes's journey into real estate, their approach to investing, including the GP-aligned platform partnership model, and how Whitman Peterson identifies potential partners. Whitman Peterson's portfolio includes cutting-edge hospitality concepts such as AutoCamp, iconic resorts such as Sundance Mountain, and leading investment management and operating businesses such as Greystar and many others across senior housing, student housing, self-storage, and more. Make sure to listen all the way to the end where you have an opportunity to win a free weekend at any AutoCamp property, courtesy of Wes Whitman, AutoCamp, and the entire Juniper Square distribution team. Let's get into it. Wes, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brandon. So glad to be here.
For our listeners who don't know you and your role in Whitman Peterson, can you give us a brief introduction to kick things off?
Yeah, you bet. So I'm the co-managing partner and co-founder of Whitman Peterson. We are a Los Angeles-based real estate investment management company. We focus on GP-aligned investing, which we'll talk more about what that means. But we have raised a number of sequential sort of flagship series funds over the years. We've been in business 14 years. And I know we'll go into a little more detail on Whitman Peterson, but just wanted to maybe just start there so people understand what business we're in, and happy to also share a little bit about my background.
So yeah, I'm very interested to dig into what GP aligned investing is. But before we do, let's learn a little bit more about you and your on-ramp into real estate. So tell me a little bit about how you got into the profession.
Sure. Yeah. In 2001, I was in college at Brigham Young University, and some classmates and I started a software business. So totally outside of real estate. We at a time where newspapers were making a big transition from print to digital, we created a software solution that could help them. And that's what we did for 3 years before I went to business school. And we ended up selling the software rights to one of the larger newspaper companies in Utah. And then the three of us went to pursue MBAs at business school. And I was lucky enough to be able to go to Harvard Business School. And as I was there, you know, there's all these different people who come to campus and you see all these great presentations from these amazing people. And I saw on the board the name of a company called Greystar, which was at the time a much less well-known company. I mean, if you think about Greystar back in 2003 and four, the company had about 60,000 apartments under management and really had not had the programmatic investment development businesses that it has today. So the AUM was sort of like under $1 billion, $300 million, I believe was the number. There are, of course, $90 billion of AUM today. So very, very different time at Greystar, 18 total people at the corporate headquarters. But at the time, I decided to go to this presentation, and Bob Faith, who's the CEO of Greystar, and Wes Fuller, who you've had on this podcast, and Bill Maddox, Derek Ramsey, they were all there. And you know, just listening to the business that they were growing and the things they wanted to do, I just had this feeling, you know, hearing these guys that, like, I said, look, I've been in technology. These guys are in real estate. I don't actually care what industry these guys are in. These are people that I want to be partners with. And it was just this feeling of partnership, this idea that they wanted to give young people big things to do that really attracted me to them. And it was kind of at a time where I, you know, didn't know a lot about what they did. The industry didn't really know Greystar well. And so I met them, was lucky enough to be able to get recruited to come down to Charleston, South Carolina. Again, lived in a small house with 18 people. That was the entire corporate headquarters. And it was an amazing experience. You know, they lived up to everything they promised to give us big things to do. And after spending 2 years at the headquarters there in Charleston and being on planes 3 or 4 days a week, you know, learning the real estate business at the feet of these amazing people, they launched me out to California to help fully establish and sort of grow the West Coast for Greystar. And I was able to do that for a number of years before starting Whitman Peterson. And I can kind of circle back, but Greystar is still a big part of, and the Greystar team is still a big part of my life professionally and personally. But that's how I got started in the business.
So did you grow up in Utah then? Because you went to undergrad at BYU and then you went to graduate school at Harvard. BYU, you were in software engineering or, you know, programming, if you will. What was the transition? How did you decide that this company called Greystar, albeit a small company, was a place that was interesting for you to work besides just the people, right? I mean, it's a very different career than, you know, being in technology or something else that you may have pursued.
It was. And just to clarify, I was definitely not the programmer and not the software engineer. I was on the business side, helping raise capital and kind of through the ideation of sort of the product that we were creating, and then certainly sales and getting customers and so forth. So I was in the finance program at BYU. I had grown up around real estate. I was lucky enough. So I grew, my first 9 years of life was in Salt Lake City. It was a wonderful place to, you know, spend those first 9 years. I had a lot of family in the area. And then my dad, whose name's Bob, I'll just call him Bob from here on out, he got asked to join the Trammell Crow Company, was recruited to Trammell Crow. So I was nine. We packed up the house and moved to Dallas, Texas in the late 80s. And my father had a chance to be there at a really critical time at the Trammell Crow Company. And, you know, names like, you know, Trammell Crow, Harlan Crow, Joel Peterson, and so many others there. I was really fortunate to sort of look at these amazing people as they were doing the great things they were doing and sort of say, wow, that would be, you know, I see how they're living their lives. I see the, you know, how ambitious they are and the different things they're doing. And so I sort of grew up around that, not ever knowing that I would do anything in real estate. My father went to the University of Utah. I went to BYU. He was in real estate. I went into technology. But I think there must have been something there where when I met the Greystar team, And some of the other, you know, private equity and real estate companies that came up to campus at business school, there was a familiarity with the quality of the humans that were involved, the way they approached life and thought about this great balance of sort of like working hard and accomplishing a lot, but also being great, you know, husbands and fathers and mothers. And so there was something that resonated sort of at the core of you know, what I had grown up around. And so I would say that probably did have an influence of me deciding to shift from maybe more of this tech approach. I was interviewing with a lot of companies in Silicon Valley. And so that really kind of got me thinking. And so that having grown up in that, you know, in that city of Dallas, Texas, at a time where real estate was sort of the big industry, and with my dad having, he was eventually became the CFO of the firm overall and head of investment management and, you know, doing some other really interesting things at Crow. And then he left Crow and joined amazing partners in Don McNamara and Dan Decker, both of whom continue to do amazing things in real estate. And a lot of people know Don and Dan, and they formed a company called the Hampstead Group, which was backed by some of the nation's largest endowments and pension funds. And so they were in kind of the real estate private equity business before that was really a thing, you know. And so I did spend a summer, you know, calling hotels and asking what their rate and occupancies were, and, you know, just before all the technology did that and other companies could do that for you. I mean, literally, I was just a list of hundreds of hotels I would just call and ask what the rate and occupancies were in high school. And that was really the only exposure I had to real estate back before I met Greystar, which, by the way, wasn't a lot. I learned a lot in the environment that summer, but I can't say that my technical skills were very refined at that point.
So when you first joined Greystar, you moved to Charleston, and then how long were you there before they sent you out west? Let's talk a little bit about kind of the tenure and the career that you had as part of that early team.
I joined there in 2005, and I was in Charleston for 2 years. And the idea was that you come to Charleston, And there was really no middle management at the time. I mean, it was basically five of us on the investment team. And then you had Bob Faith, Bill Maddox, Derek Ramsey. And at the time, Wes Fuller was actually out here in California, down in your neck of the woods in San Diego. And he had established sort of the first assets out here and had been instrumental in sort of growing the investment business out in the Western US. But there came a time where Bob Faith said, look, guys, I can hire you a boss, or the five of you can come together and figure out how to grow an investment business here, and it's up to you. And we all said, do not hire us a boss. let us go and figure this out. Wes Fuller, who had two more years of experience than the rest of us, and Wes is brilliant, as you know, and you've met Wes. Wes was, by not only default, but by all means, he was the team leader. And we were grateful to have him as the team leader. And the rest of us, we sort of divided up the country. It became clear that Wes was going to need to be back in Charleston. And that was the opportunity for me to launch into California. And at the time, each of us, we were like a, you know, kind of a band of brothers. I have to say, we're all incredibly close friends still. But growing, it being in that environment where you get to learn so closely from just such amazing people, and then also having a company that will give you enough rope where, you know, they're going to throw you in the deep end, and like right before you drown, you know, you know you've got a rope to pull you back up. It was an incredible learning environment, because, you know, they sent me to the West Coast and said, look, go figure it out. You're going to need to grow an investment business, you know, the start of a development business and an operating business, because we don't have anybody to oversee operations out there, and just go figure it out. And so it was that kind of an environment, and it was fun. You know, it was a lot of fun, and you felt the trust that these people had in you as partners, and they gave you a lot of resources and a lot of support. But there was a lot of, you know, starting from a white piece of paper and trying to figure it out. And I remember, you know, hiring the first people for Graystar on the West Coast. I would say to them, look, you know, I promise we're a real company. You know, I know you haven't heard of us, but there's this company in Charleston. They're amazing. And we do have capital and we've got resources, but it was a real, you know, it was a real leap of faith for some of these people to join. And throughout my career, I've had the chance to do that several times, where you sort of, you try to get people to see the vision of what you're going to do. And I would joke that our first holiday party would be, you know, at IHOP, and then maybe we'd, you know, graduate to something, you know, higher than that. But by the third year here on the West Coast, we had about 225 or so people here on the West Coast. And we were where the first Grammys were filmed. We were in the ballroom of the Roosevelt Hotel. And we had those original people come up to the front and talk about what it was like to join when they didn't know who the company was. And it was really fun. I mean, we grew a ton. And you know, I think part of that is the beauty of the real estate business is it's highly entrepreneurial. And Graystar was this place that gave you sort of that interesting mix of being able to be very entrepreneurial, but with the backbone and infrastructure of sort of an institutional platform and team. So that was a fun place to spend my first 5 years of my career.
I know we're going to talk about GP aligned investing in a few minutes here, but you know, before we do, you were at Graystar for about 5.5 years, as you mentioned. I'm curious, kind of what, looking back on that experience, were there any aha moments as you were building this thing from ground up? I mean, you know, going back to 2005 when you joined, multifamily wasn't exactly a, you know, kind of core institutional sector. The business wasn't exactly a household name. Bob obviously had a great career prior to starting Graystar. But, you know, when you look back on the collection of all the experiences, what stands out to you as maybe a turning point, if you will, or a pivotal aha experience?
There are so many learnings from that time period. And you're right. The industry shifted dramatically. I remember leaving business school and had friends saying, you know, gosh, why are you joining a residential company? And multifamily at the time, I'm going to get these stats wrong, but order of magnitude, you know, the vast, so I won't even say the stats, but order of magnitude, the vast majority of Graystar's third-party management clients at the time were actually mom and pop or small regional, you know, owners. And within about 2 to 3 years, that flipped on its head. And all of a sudden you were 70 to 80 or 90% institutional. Capital was pouring in from not only everywhere in the US, but coming internationally to try to access multifamily. And so seeing how fast the capital markets could shift into this new sector, and then seeing what happens to, you know, multiples or cap rates, you know, as you're in that environment, it's been really interesting. So I would say that actually that has been quite informative when we target a new sector or a new strategy within a sector, where we can start to see the first signs of institutional capital organizing around an opportunity. That actually is a key learning that we've seen, where if you can see the consumer demand leading, and then you can see capital formation starting to come at scale, that intersection was a really interesting place for us to invest. And I think that was certainly an aha moment. I think also looking at organizationally, the idea of centralized capital allocation, that's a really, really important thing. You're growing a national business. There's all sorts of different risks you're trying to manage. But having a centralized body that sort of looks across the whole country, across all strategies, you know, looks at the overall organization as a whole and is able to, you know, make those centralized capital allocation and risk decisions, that was really another sort of big aha moment. And then the third was, this really plays into what we're doing, but the third was that over time, the power of the operator has gotten, you know, tremendous. I mean, and you sort of think about, well, why? But the power that you have as an operating platform in the ability to source really unique opportunities that didn't otherwise exist, to essentially manufacture opportunities that weren't there before, not just buy a deal and just like, you know, put 10 or 15,000 per door in of renovation. I'm talking about creating, you know, really differentiated investment deal flow. The power of the operator has changed a lot. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. But and therefore, as the operator, as Greystar started to get more and more interest, becoming sort of the portal of choice for all sorts of different type of capital that recognized Greystar had, and this is applicable to other platforms as well, but, you know, having tremendous local knowledge and talent, relationships, being able to find things that other people can't find and then execute on them with scale and with excellence, capital starts organizing around that. And I remember a conversation that I had with Bob Faith, where he was like, look, we are in a position post GFC to see, you know, continued very significant growth in the business. But one constraining factor is going to be, as you continue to attract more and more joint venture equity, and this is sort of deal by deal at the time, right? This is individual asset transactions. That 10% equity piece that, you know, at the time when I was there, you know, we had to keep putting up, starts to become very substantial as you start to scale the business dramatically. And that was also an aha, because you sort of thought about, well, wait a second. I mean, if you can attract huge amounts, billions of dollars of joint venture equity, that should sort of solve all your problems. But counterintuitively, alongside billions of dollars of JV equity, needs to come hundreds of millions of dollars of GP equity. And there was absolutely, for all of us at the company, and I think in the industry, there was sort of an aha saying, wow, that GP capital is capital that can really unlock growth, or it can really limit growth. And so anyway, those, I'm sorry if I shared maybe more insights than you were looking for, but those are four key ahas that I had when I was there in those 5 years.
I think it's a great context or backdrop, because our industry is going through a similar inflection point that we went through post GFC, where people are needing to look at their businesses and assess, you know, what they need to go forward. And GP capital is a big part of that. And we're gonna come to that, you know, and let's segue. So 5.5 years at Greystar, roughly, why did you decide to leave this rocket ship that had essentially redefined institutional apartments, institutional multifamily? You were a part of, you know, a very small but early team that helped shape the identity. And I think you left, if I'm not mistaken, to form Whitman Peterson. So talk to me a little bit about what that transition in your life looked like.
You bet. I had actually planned and thought I would be at Greystar my whole career, and would have been thrilled if that had been the case. And I got a call from my dad, from Bob Whitman. And Bob called me and said, you're never going to believe this phone call I just got. This is 2009. So this is sort of coming out of the GFC. He said, you know, one of his large pension fund clients or investors from both Crow and Hampstead had called him and sort of said, Bob, he had been out of real estate for 10 plus years. And they called him and said, hey, you know, there's opportunity in the water again. Would you think of getting back into the real estate business? And they said, if you do, would you promise that you'll let us back you? And it was with a substantial commitment, maybe, you know, over $100 million. And he was just calling me to such sort of enthuse. And I was cheering him on. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, are you going to do something? That would be amazing. And so it was sort of a totally independent thing, was he was going to go do this and form this company. And then it was at a time where this GP capital need became really prevalent at Greystar. Whereas if Greystar was going to grow to where we were going to be at that time, we needed a partner. And so I called Bob and I said, hey, listen, you know, if you organize this capital, what if you guys could come be a big platform partner for us at Greystar? You know, you might be able to buy into the opco. We can do GP capital investing at the real estate level. And that was really the conversation. It wasn't even the intent for he and I to ever do anything together. And in the ensuing months, as that started to develop, it became really clear that there was an opportunity here, that probably the only thing that I would do outside of Greystar would be if I could still be involved in a really strategic way. And so the idea was that we would form this company together, that Greystar would become our first major GP platform partnership, and that we would then go try to find other Greystar-like companies in other sectors, where we'd only try to pick one or two in a given sector, and, you know, try to find sort of what we'd view as like the top national players, and just see if we could be a partner to them on their journey of growth. You know, we sort of say that it'd be like the Sherpa team that on these big climbs with them, where they would trust us to not only bring capital but to maybe also be a value add partner in the climb, and, you know, avoid some crevasses along the way, and hopefully, you know, help pick some good routes as we're trying to get to the top. So that was really how it came together. And so, you know, kind of end of 2010, you know, the fund closed. We had our first close of Whitman Peterson Fund One. Greystar, that December of 2010, we made our first GP asset level investments with Greystar. And over time, what started out as a relatively small, you know, GP capital commitment has turned into a very, very substantial relationship, where we've invested with Greystar not only across the US, but also, you know, internationally. And we've invested in more than 150 assets together, been lucky enough to be owners in their opco and on the board there currently, and have been for many years. But it honestly just feels like we're just still partners like we were in 2005, which is really awesome. What's been, I think, great is the ability to replicate that with seven other, you know, major platforms, and sort of have that same spirit, you know, of this sort of partners for life mentality together. So hope that's responsive, Brandon, to your question.
Absolutely. And when you think about Whitman Peterson today, you've been in business for what? Is it 15 years?
Going on 14 years this year.
15 years. So let's kind of zoom out. What does today look like? Size, scale, you know, you mentioned seven platforms. How many employees? What's your AUM? Whatever you share publicly, just to give us some perspective on the platform.
Sure. So we have raised essentially seven vehicles, five flagship series funds, and two sidecar vehicles that have sort of gone alongside a couple of those funds. We've grown from what started out with three of us, and even up through fund three, we only had about seven or eight people at the firm. We're still quite small. We've got 27 people here now. We've made 324 investments in transactions that would be, you know, north of probably 30 billion of AUM. Those all sound like big numbers, but sometimes when you're investing, you know, small GP capital checks, you know, calculating AUM is a little bit tricky. But we've raised about $2.5 billion of equity over that time period. And, you know, so we're kind of a smaller to mid-market, you know, real estate private equity firm. We've got a great group of people. And I mean, in our office here in Los Angeles, we've got 27 people, 12 of them come from other countries. And just, we have this just great, great sort of mix of backgrounds and, you know, ethnicities and, you know, different traditions in their lives and, you know, different professional and personal experiences. And we sort of say we want to strive for great human beings. And I feel so lucky to come to work every day working with this team.
So those 27 people, 324 transactions, roughly 2.5 billion of equity raised. You know, let's talk a little bit about kind of how you're putting that money to work. So this kind of GP aligned investing approach, what does that actually mean? Maybe kind of break it down for me.
Yeah, maybe the term GP aligned isn't one that is well known. You hear today a lot about sort of co-GP capital ideas. And I think a lot of people, especially sources of capital, are a little confused by what that really means because there's so many different meanings of it out there. You know, you think a lot of times when you're coming from the investment community, GP capital, people are thinking about that in the sort of confines of a commingled fund, right? Are you providing somebody's GP capital for their fund? I'll just define what we're doing, maybe just laying out the landscape. Most real estate is not acquired in funds. You know, most real estate is acquired in single asset transactions. And even most real estate that's acquired or developed, and particularly development is done outside of commingled funds primarily, even with the biggest platforms. But across the country, if you just think about the fact that most real estate transactions happen one deal at a time, maybe somebody buys a portfolio, but they're happening on individually capitalized assets. And in those individually capitalized assets, usually 90% of the capital is coming from a large outside equity source. You know, call it we'll call it JV equity or what I'll say LP equity, but you know, JV equity partner. It could be an insurance company, it could be an allocator fund, like one of the big bulge bracket private equity funds. It could be a number of other capital sources, but it's generally coming from the capital source through an intermediary to the operator. And that's, you know, kind of 90% of the money. And then 10% of the money is required to be put up by the sponsor of the deal themselves. It's the developer, the operator, whoever it may be. And I'll just call that GP capital. There have been a number of companies these operating companies who are looking at different ways to fund that GP capital. If you think about the plight of the operator, there aren't a lot of operators who are out trying to build really scalable operating platforms. If you think about it, real estate, as we say, is sort of a take-home business. You go and you do projects, you take the profit home, and you just take it home. It takes a really thoughtful entrepreneur to say, I'm not going to take that profit home. I'm going to roll that back into my operating company. I'm going to build the technology and the systems and the people and the offices and the scale to grow a world-class company that can execute across the whole country or across the world. That is really hard to do. And so those who are doing it, they have to take a bunch of the profit they're making from their investments and from the operating business and roll that back into the company. And if you're a regional operator, it's actually hard to be super profitable in the opco. So you're really using mostly your real estate profits to roll back into the operating platform. So if you're growing your footprint of your portfolio at the same time that you're trying to grow the footprint of your operating business so you can execute on the real estate really well, that creates a real need for GP capital because there just isn't enough capital to go around. And when you're talking about 5 or 10 million or maybe 15 or 20 million, that's a lot of money to anybody, but you can, a lot of people can go to, you know, kind of one or two concentric circles out in their network and raise that money. When you start to scale to 30 or 40 or 50 million or into 100 million or more, which a lot of our platforms are at that level, you know, that is not something you're going to the country club or friends and family for, right? That's you're essentially saying there is a permanent piece of my business over the next, you know, decade. As I continue to grow, that need for that 10% equity is only going to get bigger. And the need for you to continue to pour money into the platform is only going to get bigger as well. So the plight of the operator, if there's a plight, is simply this sort of balance between all the money they're trying to go put in to build their platform and then that 10% GP co-invest that happens at the asset level. And so different operators solve it differently. Some operators say, I'm going to raise the capital at the opco level, and then I'll take that and put it down into the real estate. And there's pros and cons of that. And others say, no, I don't want to sell any part of my opco to raise that capital. I'm going to do that separately. And I'm just going to raise these pools of GP capital that I can use to put into the real estate itself. We can talk about the pros and cons of those. There are pros and cons of those. But that's sort of, let me stop there and see what questions you may have on the, that's the situation the operators are in. is there, it's a decision of like, do I keep growing at the scale that I know I can grow at? And if the answer is yes, how am I going to fuel that GP commit that I need at the asset level of every one of my deals? And do I do that through the opco or proc? Let me stop there, Brandon, and see what questions you have at that point.
So just to clarify, so for Whitman Peterson, you laid out the two different models, and we've had prior guests. I know you've listened to some of the episodes who have a different approach in this space. But for your model, you're focused on the asset level GP capital required, or do you also have strategic capital that can go into the opco? Is it one or the other or either?
Yeah. So it's just sort of maybe laying out the landscape. For our strategy, the reason that we like to do asset level investing primarily, so 90%+, even up to 95% of any of our fund capital is in individual asset real estate decisions. And our investors are really, you know, they're investing in Whitman Peterson because they want us to be making judgment calls on the real estate level decisions. Okay, what sectors are we in? What markets are we going into? What types of product strategies do we have? And what partners are we investing with? And they want us to make those decisions. So by investing at the asset level, we have deal by deal approval on everything. You know, you're not relying on selling the opco in order to exit the real estate. And so we really like that idea. So that 95% of our capital roughly is invested in asset level ventures with our partners. We do have the ability within the fund to make opco investments. And we generally do that when it's going to add value to one of our partners. So maybe they're acquiring one of their competitors, or maybe they, you know, have a partner who has retired and they want somebody to come in who can be an active partner in the firm. Or maybe they just have other motivations where they just feel like, look, we'd like to bring you guys in as a strategic partner, have you on our boards and investment committees. And we've had every one of those situations occur. And so we do have opco interest in almost all the platforms that we have partnerships with, but the way that our sort of structure is, those individual opcos are evaluated as single investment decisions. The rights that we have for extended runway to the pipelines of our platform partners, think about that as sort of sitting at like the Whitman Peterson opco level, spanning numerous funds. So we'll negotiate with our partners, but we'll work out the details with our partners of what a long-term partnership looks like. That partnership will generally span multiple funds so that we know we have access to those pipelines across fund after fund after fund. If we happen to make an opco investment, that might sit in Whitman Peterson Fund 3, and then we may exit that opco investment. In the future, and this has happened, we might invest again in the opco with a different fund for a different purpose, why they needed more capital. So that's our model. And the reason why we call it GP aligned investing is that our model has never been about just providing GP capital. The idea has been for us, if we can form really strategic GP partnerships, we can leverage the full ecosystem of opportunities. So, you know, in every investment, we have a GP capital investment. But there's several strategies where the LP, you know, that 90% JV equity component is actually very attractive to us. And we'll programmatically say, hey, we'll go ahead and take the 90% piece on that entire pipeline, you know, of opportunities. And that generally tends to be in more of the niche sort of strategies, tends to be where us being the aggregator can add value, where us controlling both the debt and the equity piece based on how we think the exit might work, you know, is important. And so even from fund one, you know, we've had a portion of our fund that has always taken advantage of sort of that LP component, the opco components. And so that's why we call it GP aligned, is it's not that we're just a pure play co-GP capital provider, never have been, but that GP capital is a component on every asset we invest in. And it sort of, you know, provides that seat at the table for us, you know, when we're in these, you know, with these great partners that we have, to sort of see everything coming across the ecosystem and be able to then, you know, leverage that on behalf of our investors, no matter what the place in the capital stack might be.
There's been a lot of talk about GP stakes, opco, propco investing. We're talking about that now. You mentioned there's pros and cons to each of these models. If you're a GP listening to this podcast in search of strategic capital, you know, what might you share with somebody who's thinking about, you know, who thinks that what they really need is opco capital, right? You touched on it before, and I know you do it strategically, as you just said, when alignment makes sense. But what's the downside of that model?
You know, I would think about this. The opco capital investments we're making, they are not related to GP capital for real estate. And if you're an operator, we actually had one of our operating platforms had hired an investment advisor. They were going to go out to market to do a GP capital sort of fund, if you will, or you know, venture. And it came across our desk through, we actually got it, you know, before they went out to market through a relationship that we had internally with this platform. And we actually said to them, look, if you're going to do it the way you're going out to market to do it, we don't have any interest in being involved. And we actually don't think it's the right thing for you all. And they said, they were confused. They're like, well, what are you talking about? We said, think about it. You're projecting that you're going to need 30 million of GP capital over the next few years. And, but the thing is, you're going to grow faster than you think, because all of our partners do grow faster than they think. And so what happens a year and a half from now when you need another 30 million, but let's say it's not 30 million, let's say it's 50 million to keep fueling the growth. You're going to have to keep selling down your operating business, you know, and all of a sudden these people who've built these great companies, you know, just to fund real estate related equity are having to give away huge pieces of their business over time. And that's not, we don't think that is generally in their best interest. And there's probably great use cases where it could be of, you know, great interest to them. But from our perspective, you know, we said, essentially said, look, if you're willing to do what we think is in your best interest and take the GP capital piece, we'll still put money into the opco to help you grow the platform, but take the GP capital piece, put it outside the opco. We need deal by deal approval. That gets us deal by deal approval. It allows you to scale. And with that platform, by the way, what started out as a $30 million commitment has now been over $70 million in that same time period that we have now done. And they haven't had to sell down any more of their opco to make that happen. So we still have our opco position in that company, and they're an amazing partner, and they've grown the platform tremendously. But that we felt like for them, that was a better solution. And I think today they would, well, I know they would tell you they are grateful that that's how they did it.
When you're investing deal by deal into the GP and you have kind of decision-making rights, how do you think about your platforms across different sectors, across different geographies? This is a very broad, or maybe you can tell me, but it seems that it would be a very broad remit. How do you kind of rationalize the need to be, have expertise in these sectors and geographies with the ability to move quickly to approve decisions to invest in the specific deals where you have, you know, either a first right of refusal or veto rights or whatever it may be?
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess if the alternative is that we're a fund of funds, you know, which I think is the alternative to that, right? I mean, essentially, or something that would mirror a fund of funds, you know, in our view, that's really not what our investors are hiring us to do. Okay. Our investors are looking to us to, as I mentioned, sort of make sector selection decisions. So not only the sectors that we choose, but the sectors we avoid. Right. And then I think what our partners would tell you, our operating partners would tell you this, and they just, we had our EGM last week and at Sundance, as you know, in Utah. And, you know, what we were very appreciative of is our partners talking about things Whitman Peterson does to be high impact partners. And one of them said, in addition to getting an investment partner, we feel like we're also getting an operating partner as well. We're only really investing in sectors where we have deep domain expertise. And we've got a broad team of people who come from a variety of different great places and have had their own sets of unique experiences in the different sectors they've been in. But our mentality is we want to invest in assets and in sectors where we can actually add value to what's happening at the real estate level. Maybe just share one example of that. We have an outdoor hospitality partner called AutoCamp. And I think you're familiar with them, Brandon, but it's a great concept. It's, you know, these really high quality, I'll say Airstream hotels, but it's, that wouldn't do justice to what these really are. They are, you know, beautiful clubhouses, really amazing sort of boutique hotel finishes inside of these Airstreams. And it gets people to the outdoors if they don't want to be, you know, sleeping on the ground in a tent, you know, and it sort of bridges this gap for people between nature and not compromising on the quality of your overnight accommodation. People who go to AutoCamp love AutoCamp. our guest satisfaction scores there are off the charts. Just not enough people know about the platform yet, you know? And so you think about how do you get like national and global awareness to this incredible brand that's been created. And so what we did at Whitman Peterson was we leveraged our experience in the hospitality market, and we called the CEOs of Hilton and Marriott and said, guys, we know this is going to sound crazy. We only have six of these open and operating right now, but would you have interest in doing something here? And you may, I don't know if you know this, Brandon, but we, as of August, we finalized and fully launched our platform with Hilton. AutoCamp is on the Hilton platform. You can use Hilton Honors points. There's now, you know, almost 200 million Hilton Honors members that can now access AutoCamp. But that's one example of a way that Whitman Peterson and AutoCamp, by the way, was obviously highly involved in helping lead the entire process there. But it was sort of this idea of us coming together as partners and saying, okay, well, how could Whitman Peterson help here? How could we dramatically open up the floodgates from a demand perspective? You know, I hope it wouldn't be presumptuous to say we can probably give you, you know, lots and lots of examples across our different platform partnerships where we're striving to have a similar impact, where our involvement hopefully makes a difference. So that's really why we do the model that we're doing, is we're trying to add value at the asset level as high impact partners as well.
Yeah. I love that. And I am familiar with AutoCamp. I saw the deal with Hilton, and that's super exciting to take what I think is a really differentiated product and make it more broadly available. And I haven't stayed at one yet, but it's on, as you know, it's on our list. I think I'm going to probably host an event at one soon. I know you've done that. And we've actually had other clients host there. We have one client I know who hosted their AGM at the AutoCamp in, I believe, in Joshua Tree, if I'm not mistaken, and absolutely loved it. So I think that's a perfect example of some of the ways you add value. I just came from an event last week. This is September 2024 when we're recording this, where we brought together about 100 CEOs of real estate investment management companies from about $1 billion of equity to call it $100 billion of equity. And the specific topic was thinking about building and creating enterprise value. And just this morning, I posted on LinkedIn that there's a difference between an investment partnership and a business. And the idea there is that an investment partnership is, you know, a group of people who could do deals together and probably generate some pretty good returns. But as a entity, as an organization, the sum of all the deals isn't really worth anything to a new buyer. But a business which has durable value, you know, durable fee, durable income streams, a true enterprise value is worth a lot. And, you know, we all have the data what these companies are trading at right now, and it's substantial. In your business, you've been a part of evaluating and investing alongside and into many different kind of businesses. How do you think about what makes a business and kind of what's really important from an enterprise value perspective that you look for in your partners?
Yeah, great question. And that is a big topic today. It's a big topic for these operating businesses. It's also a big topic for the investment management businesses that are out there as well. But thinking about the operating business side of it, I think it really comes down to sort of like the blocking and tackling that's happened over many decades of you know, valuing companies from a private equity perspective. I mean, we tend to only invest in businesses where there's a diversified income stream, right? Where, I mean, because you think about it, like development businesses will trade at like 3 to 4 times EBITDA generally, right? Because it's a cyclical business. You've got, you know, property management businesses that, depending on the scale, can have a very wide variety, but they're not generally not getting sort of, you know, 15 to 20 times multiples for property management companies, right? If any of our partners have a core, you know, kind of perpetual life investment business, those do get very, very high multiples, right? And if you have a really unique concept, like an AutoCamp, like we were just talking about, or some others that, you know, those can trade, you know, 25 times, you know, multiples. So we look at it very similarly, probably to how others might, where you're looking at sort of the durability and the predictability of the cash flows. And obviously the more durable and the more predictable and the bigger growth potential, the higher the multiple you're going to pay for that, you know, stream of cash flows. I think what's really interesting to me is, and I don't know if this is obvious to everybody, maybe I'm the only one who is surprised by this, but there are a lot of regional companies out there that are surprisingly unprofitable. You know, where you'd think, gosh, there's a big national platform. Maybe they have, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 units of whatever sector they're in. The scale that it takes to actually have a very profitable operating business is substantial. It is very substantial. And the people that are making the investments in technology, I mean, one of our partners has a 20-person AI and technology team. Another one is rolling tens of millions of dollars into just the IT line item this year alone. I mean, they're rolling in more into their IT line item than probably the sum of the EBITDA of their nearest competitors, just going into IT. And so I think what at least we're observing, and I think what others will observe, is that over time, companies that have the scale advantage, if they can keep investing the way they have into that infrastructure, they are going to keep becoming more and more and more valuable. And they're not only going to be more valuable at the opco level, but they drive more NOI to the real estate that they're involved in as well. And so as we think about those types of businesses, those become very special businesses because they can be diversified. They have property management streams, revenue streams. They've got investment management revenue streams. They have development revenue streams. Within investment management, they have, you know, one-off joint ventures. They may get into the commingled fund business. They may have more core capital. And so as you look at platforms that are establishing that broad base, not only geographically, but by business line, you know, those become very, very valuable businesses. So I think those are the people who are focused on the enterprise. And as I mentioned before, there are a lot of people who aren't focused on the enterprise, and that's okay. I mean, that's just a decision. And those people can do very well, you know, financially through the real estate investments they make, and in some cases through the opcos. But I think what you're going to see and what is just this continued consolidation. And we've already seen it over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. I think that consolidation is going to continue. And the importance of the operating platform is going to continue. You're seeing some of the biggest global private equity funds try to vertically integrate all the way and doing it successfully, vertically integrating into that sort of either establishing their own operating platforms or buying operating platforms and rolling them in. I think you'll continue to see that because of the value, not only it creates at the opco level, but the value that those businesses can create in the real estate, both in the scale of the pipelines and the profitability of the assets themselves. I think we'll continue to see that importance increase.
Is there some threshold that you think about in your mental model of crossing to be able to get the advantages of scale? How do you think about that? Because, you know, just as a point of comparison, I talk to, you know, I very much agree with your sentiment on where the industry is going. I think the local operators and sharpshooters will continue to flourish and some may stay small by design. And there's going to be continued consolidation in the mega managers, whether that's 6 or 12 or 24 or 48. I don't really know the right number, but the bigger are going to continue to get bigger. And the middle, I think, is far bigger than most people think. And in my, you know, mental model of the middle, based on conversations I have, it's from 5 billion of equity to 80 billion of equity. And if you're sitting in that range, you're thinking about differentiation. You're thinking about how do you get to scale? You're thinking about platform, product, distribution, all of these things. So when you mentioned scale before and those investments in technology and those investments in the operating platform, maybe help us contextualize what scale means to you.
Yeah. So I think what you're talking about is scale at the investment management platform level, if I'm understanding you, Brandon. So my prior comments were really about scale at the operating company level. I think scale at the investment management level, that's a really interesting question. And it's one that, you know, sort of maybe take us as a case study. I mean, we're still pretty small, right? I mean, $2.5 billion of equity raised, and that's growing. But you know, we're really not, we probably should be more focused on enterprise value of our own business. But there is this interesting balance between, like, do you just become, you know, sort of an AUM shop where you're relying on fees, or are you really out there to go make money for your investors and for the team at sort of the fund level, right? And I think for us, we've really continued to be focused on not trying to build a family of funds. you know, where we have, I mean, people ask us a lot, like, oh, are you going to get into core and you're going to leverage the core space? Well, we'll do that if our investors would find value in us doing that. We're not going to do that just to grow AUM. And what we're finding over time is that, you know, as we continue to focus on fund level investing and the profitability of those funds, and we continue to back these big platforms, there are opportunities at our opco level, if you will, for the business to keep growing, you know, for our investment management business to keep growing. But it's a bit of a different lens than maybe some might have, which is sort of, hey, how can we grow our enterprise value as Whitman Peterson as big as possible? We're still just really focused on trying to drive value at the fund level. If we can prove that we can do that time after time after time, you know, over decades and decades and decades, you know, there's probably going to be some enterprise value there for our business, but that's, you know, it's not something that we're focused on at our level. We're just kind of focused on the fund side.
I appreciate that clarification. And then when you think about it for the operating level, the opco, how do you think about kind of critical scale? Is it just market leadership, or is there some number or metric that you use to track that?
It's really by sector, right? I mean, if you're in industrial versus, you know, student housing versus multifamily, look, everybody has different, you know, models of how they're going to operate. In my personal experience, you know, I think it's once you start to get to that 60, 70, 80, 90,000 unit sort of range, you know, the economics start to become, you know, the flow through on every incremental dollar of revenue can become substantial. And until you're there, you know, it still can be a profitable business. It's just that the flywheel really starts spinning, you know, as you get to those bigger levels. And I think that some companies, if you look at companies that some of our partners have done either large third-party management programmatic deals with or companies they've acquired, is some of these businesses that have primarily been focused on the development business or the acquisition business, it's kind of like, they're like, well, is it worth it? Like, is it worth all the effort for us to try to scale our third-party business to get that big? Or should we just outsource that to one of the big third-party managers? And I think that's a choice. You know, it is a big choice. And I think you're seeing a lot of people deciding, gosh, that's a hard business. It's hard to scale. There's some people doing it really, really well. You know, maybe I'd be better off focusing on the development and investment side of the business and then outsourcing that operating side to somebody else. And I think we'll continue to see that happen across multiple sectors in the industry.
So we're recording this, as I mentioned before, in September of 2024. As you look forward over the next 12 to 18 months, what sectors are you choosing to focus on, either within your existing portfolio of operating, you know, companies and assets, or new sectors that you, or geographies that you'd like to add going forward?
We are really focused on what many are calling sort of the alternative living sector strategy. So if you think about not as much traditional multifamily, and we haven't really done a lot of traditional multifamily since 2018, but if you think about sort of the life cycle of the renter, and you think about your first apartment being maybe a student apartment, right? So student housing, we continue to be very excited about everything we're doing in student. And we can talk about why, but the student is a big area of focus. Once you graduate from college and you're kind of finding those first apartments, you know, as you know, a lot of multifamily was built at the luxury end of the range, you know, kind of an arms race in terms of, you know, the amenities and so forth. And the price points have gotten so high that people are paying such a big part of their overall paycheck, you know, to live in an apartment, that it's becoming unsustainable. And so this idea of, you know, providing housing that is at a more attainable rent level is something that is very compelling to us. With the housing shortage in America and globally, but that certainly in America, this idea of being able to build a product that, you know, kind of the fat part of the bell curve, you know, needs is very compelling. As people continue to age in life, the idea of active adult apartments, you know, we have been on the forefront of that for the last, you know, 8 or 9 years, where between, you know, a partnership we have with Greystar, and then where Carlyle has provided a lot of the LP equity programmatically, we're on the GP side. We've got just this great partnership. We've built one of the larger, well, it's currently the largest active adult platform in the country. We have a new relationship within active adult as well that we're pursuing. And so that, and that's, sort of the living sector across that broad strategy. I would say like tangential to the living sector is this idea of people who need a 60 to 90 day place to stay. They don't want to sign a lease on an apartment. It might be a contract nurse who's got an assignment for 3 months. It could be a software engineer doing a big implementation for a big company and they want to go Monday through Thursday. If you think about what their options are, it's pretty limited. I mean, you got corporate apartments, but that a lot of times that exceeds the budgets of a lot of the companies in America who are sending those workers out for 2 to 3 months at a time. You know, other solutions, but if you look at sort of the hotel solutions, you know, there really are not a lot of good options out there. And so, and if you're trying to stay at a price point of, you know, say between $1,800 and $2,500 a month, we have a couple of really interesting strategies we're doing in that space, sort of the 60 to 90 day. We call it short stay apartments. You could call it long stay hotels, but it operates a lot more like an apartment than it does a hotel. And the operating model is very similar. And the margins are very similar to apartment margins. So we're doing a lot in that space. And so let's call that the broader sort of living sector and adjacent strategies. Self-storage kind of follows that quite well. And we have a storage platform that we are really excited about. And then really other than that, it's a combination of logistics with, you know, us continuing to do last mile logistics in places where, you know, they just don't exist. You can't really acquire them in these growing suburban areas where there's a lot of population and job growth. You know, we're coming in with these, you know, kind of shallow bay logistics warehouses that service, you know, that last mile distribution. And then finally, sort of experiential travel. You know, we like this idea of, you know, people wanting to go do something different than how they've traveled in the past. So this, you know, this auto camp strategy is a good one, a good example of that. So probably 50% of what we invest in is in that living sector, probably another 30 is in logistics. And then, you know, kind of the other 20% is a combination of storage and experiential travel. Those are the sectors we have the most conviction on.
And I had the pleasure of seeing you recently in Utah, and I know that you have an investment in Sundance Resort, I believe. Where does that fit in? And, you know, for all of our skier friends listening who maybe have heard of Sundance and haven't yet been but want to go, I think it's a pretty incredible asset that you've been able to turn around or in the process of reinvigorating.
We're super excited about Sundance. Where it sort of fits is we have 5% of our fund that we always kind of reserve for special opportunities. These are things that maybe are not part of a big programmatic GP relationship, but we don't do any investing personally in real estate outside of our funds. And Sundance was something that came to us personally through some relationships that we have with the people sponsoring that investment. And we just said, look, since we're not going to do it personally, it's got to fit the fund. And we sort of tucked that into our special situations or special opportunities bucket. It definitely fits within an experiential travel, you know, sort of category as well. But that's, you know, look, Robert Redford did an incredible job and his team for, you know, over 50 years. Sort of having stewardship over that amazing resort. We use the same words that we feel like we're stewards over that incredible asset. And the team that is involved there, which is Broadreach Capital and Cedar Partners, they have just done an absolutely amazing job. And the on-site team has done an amazing job. And Sundance will continue to be the great place it's always been. And there will be some much needed just sort of infrastructure improvements that just make the whole experience just even better. So excited about that one.
Looking forward to visiting again soon. For our listeners who want to learn more about Whitman Peterson, they want to get in touch with you. Maybe they even have an idea that they want to share with you. What's the best way for them to learn more or contact you or a member of your team?
Wes@WhitmanPeterson.com. That's a really easy way to do it. So.
All right. Well, tell them you heard Wes on the Distribution Podcast, and hopefully it bubbles to the top of your inbox. But Wes, I've really enjoyed this conversation like so many others we've had before today. I look forward to continuing to watch the success of your team, you and your team at Whitman Peterson, and continuing to have dialogue on the evolution of our business. So thanks for joining me today.
Well, Brandon, thank you. And I do want to say, I think that you have... I mean, you've been so nice to ask me all these questions, and I know you were planning to probably just end this right there, but I want to say this. I mean, the way that you study the market and the relationships that you have built and your whole team at Juniper Square is really amazing. And I've listened to several of the podcasts that you've done. I've seen, you know, the roster of everybody who's participated. It's a complete honor for me to be here. And I just want to thank you for the chance to be here with you and appreciate our friendship and our, you know, the times we have to sort of share ideas and brainstorm and the ways you're trying to help us in our business. So I really appreciate that.
Well, the feeling's mutual. No, we appreciate and thank you for the kind words. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff. Or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.